everyone. Before we start, I wanted to let you know, if you would like to watch our whole service, head to our website. That's dc2.me. And from the media drop-down, click sermons. You can watch our whole service there. And now, here's this week's sermon.
Good morning, Discovery. Today's teaching is anchored in Deuteronomy chapter 26, starting in verse 1. It says this: Once you enter the land that God your God is giving you as an inheritance, and you take it over and you settle down, you are to take some of all the first fruits of what you've grown in the land that God your God is giving you, put them in a basket, go to the place God your God sets apart for you to worship him. At that time, go to the priest who is there and say, I announce to God, your God, today that I have entered the land that God promised our ancestors that he'd give to us. The priest will take the basket from you and place it on the altar of God, your God. And there in the presence of God, your God, you will recite. A wandering Aramean was my father. He went down to Egypt and sojourned there. He and just a handful of his brothers at first, but soon they became a great nation, mighty and many. The Egyptians abused and battered us in a cruel and savage slavery. We cried out to God, the God of our fathers. He listened to our voice. He saw our destitution, our trouble, our cruel plight, and God took us out of Egypt with his strong hand and a long arm, terrible and great, with signs and miracles and wonders. And he brought us to this place, gave us this land flowing with milk and honey. So here I am. I've brought my first fruits of what I've grown on the ground that you gave me, O God. And then you place it in the presence of God, your God. Bow low in the presence of God, your God, and rejoice. Celebrate all the good things that God your God has given you and your family, you and the Levite and the foreigner who lives with you. My name is Zach, and I'm one of the pastors here. I've had a bunch of moments in my life that felt like conversion moments, like something big just shifted and happened there. Have you had moments like this in your life? As we go through our teaching today, it's so important that you hear over and over again, this is a teaching about your story more than anything else. Your story matters when it comes to this place, this teaching, everything going on. Probably my favorite moment like this in my life, it was between about my sophomore, junior year of college, and was really having a lot of trouble. 9/11 had happened like 3 weeks into my freshman year. I was at a school in Los Angeles. I didn't know anybody, and my first couple years were great. But in the midst of a really tumultuous first few weeks of college, leaving home, all that kind of stuff, there was a bunch of things in my life that just started to absolutely have a 10-car pileup in my soul. Emotionally, I was all over the map. Spiritually, I was all over the map. For me, in my particular story, I was also at a Christian college and really felt like I've got to look like I've got it together. Like, you can't be losing your stuff at Christian college. Like, you got to be okay. And that, I was really good at that for about 9 months. And by about the end of freshman year, for sure going into sophomore year, found myself in counseling, which I was under the impression at the time, like, counseling's for like super whacked out people. And then finding like, oh, I'm super whacked out people. Cool, okay. My therapist was great. And over the course of time, really began uncovering some things in my family of origin, some things that were actions of my own, things that I had done in my life and to my story. And just distinctly remember, like, so here's the moment, this time where I just stood up, like, and I'm a big dude, so when I stand up and start yelling, which does not happen often, like, it's a moment for me too, pointing my finger at my therapist saying, you don't understand. It's like I need somebody else who knows what they're doing to come into my life and clean up all this crap. And then they can't leave, because if they leave, I'm just going to screw it all up again. They would like need to stay there and like keep things tidy. And then I fell back in my chair because I realized this is a story that I have known my entire life, and I didn't know that I needed it until right now. I was great at holding it together until I needed somebody else to hold me. What have been conversion moments in your life?
Have you had moments? Maybe they don't resolve. Maybe it's just a moment of like, I just have this guttural need, this cry for something, and I'm waiting for response. Maybe you, like me, have also had moments where you go, I have had those. I currently have those. I also have had some where I find myself just in this guttural moan that's met in a particular moment. And the story that we're all about today is a moment of this guttural cry that's met. And I'm just deliriously excited to explore this with you. We're starting a new series today, and it's a series that's on money. And some of you just went, oh, crap, this is the one we want to try and miss every year. Some of you have shared with me that one thing that you hate about going to churches is that some churches it just feels like you walk into and they're always asking for money. And to you, I hope today that I have some good news. Like, take a big, deep breath if this is you. I am not asking you for money today. If you hear that as the point of this teaching, then I have done a really bad job. Money is going to be involved, just to be clear. But money is not the point of all of this. My hope today is that you hear me telling you some good news about the heart of God, the hope of humankind, the joy of being alive. That's where we're headed today. And whether you grew up in church or not, when it comes to money, there seems to just be this general rule of thumb of like you're supposed to be giving to no matter what the spiritual background is, the organization or the deity or both, like there's just you're supposed to just do that. But actually, it's interesting that every spiritual demographic that I've heard of and have studied believes in giving a financial gift. How much? It's really compelling that 10%, a tithe, is almost always the case. Interestingly, when you look back through history, even most of the religions that have spawned, religions that are still around today, Judaism, Islam, but even like the Babylonian religions, the Mesopotamians, the Greeks, the Egyptians, all had this idea of 10%. It's really interesting. And everyone that I could study had a similar reason for what the 10% was for, what it was doing. God is hungry. He needs your food and your drink to be sustained. The gods depend on us, and if I keep my end of the bargain, the gods will be good to me in return. However, at least in Judaism and Christianity, there seems to be a different motivation behind it. These verses that we just read out of Deuteronomy 26 come from this teaching that Moses was giving to the Hebrew people as they were coming out of Egypt. If you've ever seen the movie Prince of Egypt, it's this just amazing moment for the nation of what will become Israel. But when this speech is happening, when these words are written down, they haven't arrived in the land of Israel yet. They're just headed that direction. And this comes, this speech that you're supposed to give when you bring your first fruits, it comes in a whole list of laws and rules that God is giving these people. But this is really the first one that comes with a speech that you have to give. I mean, he's talking about things like the Sabbath day. But on Saturday or Sunday, whenever you keep it, there's not like a speech that's written down for you that you're supposed to give. It's odd. And when you honor your father and mother, there's not a speech that you give when you do that, although some of us are really good at giving those speeches. Why do you give a speech, like this specific speech, when you bring your first fruits? And it's this idea of like, these are the first, this is the first of my crop in this culture that grew this year. Here's the first of it. Why do you give a speech here? And this whole idea is rooted in a story. This story about a kid named Jacob. Jacob was the grandson of a guy named Abraham. Abraham's son Isaac had two sons, Esau and Jacob. They were twins. Some of you have parented twins. I don't know how you do that. There's like a special place in heaven if you've somehow managed to navigate raising more than one baby at a time. It's incredible. So Isaac is on this list of folks. Esau, Jacob's older brother, born first, came out with Jacob literally clutching on to his heel. It's like this crazy episode of Chicago Med, just instead of being in the back of the Uber driver's cab, it's like they're in a tent in the desert type of a thing. It's crazy. And these boys grow up, and they're very different. You've got Esau, who is essentially sponsored by Bear Grylls and Game of Thrones, if you can build that personality. And then you've got Jacob, who Let's just say he's sponsored by like video games in his mom's basement. He's that type of guy. Very different brothers. But Jacob is smart. So smart, in fact, that he figures out how to steal his brother's inheritance. And while he's technically doing it by the book, he's conniving and he's unjust. And this whole move that he does ends up just tearing his family apart. His brother literally starts coming after him, like, "I am going to kill you." And so Jacob just takes off running. His mom grew up in an area called Aramea. And his uncle Laban, he still lives there. So as he's running, it just seems like that's the best direction to run. And I'm going to go to my uncle Laban's house. But it's 450 miles away. So just to contextualize this for us, this would be like saying, I'm going to run from here to Albuquerque. 450 miles. Can you begin wrapping your head around how freaked out this kid is? You're going to run from here to Albuquerque. Like, this isn't just, I'm going to go hide out in Fort Collins for a couple weeks. This is like, I got to get way out of Dodge. I'm jumping county lines. And he gets about 30 miles out, which basically from here to Castle Rock. And that's day one. And if you can imagine a long walk or a run from here to Castle Rock, you're going to be pretty tired. And it's pretty clear that he hadn't had time to pack because he grabs his pillow, which was the closest rock, and he goes down for a hard sleep. It's so hard to convey the terror that he must have been feeling to go that far on foot, not even on horseback. I want you to try and paint the scene in your head a little bit of what's Jacob up to right now. The scene, like the physical setting, this is like the Wild West. He's not hitchhiking down I-25. He's crossing wilderness and desert that plays host to every kind of animal that wants to kill you, not to mention the humans that are wandering under the lack of law enforcement in this particular area. This is not good. So just to like get us in the mindset, here's what's going on with Jacob. We've got a homeless kid. He's running from home because this dude has messed up. He has nothing. I mean, at this point, he has no future. He has no hope. And this kid is afraid and he is doomed. I mean, he's probably going to be robbed or eaten or both. Probably the best realistic outcome he can hope for is that somebody captures him and he becomes enslaved. This is a bad spot to be in. And then we find ourselves in the story, starting in Genesis chapter 28, verse 10. And this is where we catch in to our friend Jacob. Jacob left Beersheba and he went to Haran. He came to a certain place and he camped there for the night. This is Castle Rock, since the sun had set. And he took one of the stones there, and he set it under his head, and he laid down to sleep. And he dreamed. A stairway was set on the ground, and it reached all the way to the sky. Angels of God were going up and going down on it. And then God was right there before him, saying, "I am God, the God of your grandpa and of your dad. And I'm giving you the ground on which you are sleeping to you and to your descendants. Your descendants will be as the dust of the earth. They'll stretch from west to east, from north to south. All the families of the earth will bless themselves in you and your descendants. Yes, I'll stay with you. I'll protect you wherever you go. I'll bring you back to this very ground, and I'll stick with you until I've done everything I've promised you." Jacob woke up from his sleep. He said, "God is in this place, truly, and I didn't even know it." He was terrified. He whispered in awe, "Incredible, wonderful, holy. This is God's house, the gate of heaven." Jacob was up first thing in the morning. He took the stone that he had used for his pillow. He stood it up as a memorial pillar, and he poured oil over it. He christened the place Bethel, God's house. And the name of that town has been Luz until then. Jacob vowed a vow. "If God stands by me, protects me on this journey on which I'm setting out, if he keeps me in food and clothing and brings me back in one piece to my father's house, this God will be my God. The stone that I have set up as a memorial pillar will mark this as a place where God lives. And everything you give me, I'll return a tenth to you. It's so important to read these lines in context. Can you imagine how this felt to Jacob? He's homeless, he's running, he's messed up, he has nothing, he's afraid. And then God says this, I'm going to give you this ground to your descendants. Which if you're Jacob in this moment, one of the things that just collides in your brain is, that means I'm going to live long enough to actually have descendants. That might mean I actually get married at some point. Clearly, there's going to be enough to support all of those people. Like, what on earth's going on here? God's not done. God says, I'll increase your descendants. Which if you're in Jacob's head, you're going, you're not just going to do good for me, but you're going to do good for my whole family. You're going to continue to care for everyone who comes after me. Not to mention in a Middle Eastern culture, this is conveying so much that we don't have time to get into today. You're going to care for generations. God says, I'll bless the whole earth through you. And man, for a kid who can't even be a gift to his own family, this has to be a bit confusing. To be told that not only will a little good happen through you, but a world-changing amount of good. Are we starting to get a scope for how crazy this dream is? God says, I'll stay with you. I will simply be present. And for Jacob, it's a moment in utter loneliness to realize, if this is true, I am no longer alone on the road. And there's a long way left to go to my uncle's house. But more than that, I don't deserve anybody to be with me. You want to be with me? What does that say about my identity? Why would you want to do this? God says, not only that, but I'll protect you. I'm not just going to stand by if you start getting robbed or enslaved or eaten. I've got you. I'm like your stand-in bodyguard. And again, for Jacob, these ideas of identity and value and why me? What have I done? God says, I'll bring you back here. Which I think seems like an odd thing to say. Why not just say, no matter where you go, no matter what happens, but what becomes clear is that this place is home. This is where Jacob, where his family, this is where they're supposed to be. And maybe even more importantly, God is telling them, this is the place where we're supposed to be together. Like for a long time. And I just want to point out, it's so beautiful in the text that God doesn't finish this and then say, and then here's your part of the contract. He just, like, period. This is what I'm going to do for you, Jacob. Unconditional and a vow. What would you say if you were Jacob in this moment? What would you do? I mean, in the scene, this is like God essentially pulling up like some random truck driver, pulling over to a kid at a rest stop, and just like, here's all this good that I just want to speak over you. Promises, care, longevity. Who is this guy? So if you're Jacob, you have some options. One of them is to stop eating Taco Bell right before bed because these freaking dreams. Am I right? Like, what is going on? But another option is you just straight up laugh in his face. Yeah, freaking right. Do you even see what's going on here? You're a moron. Clearly you're not God. Because my situation right now, it's not super redeemable. And me as a person, I mean, with everything that I've done and with the things that have been done to me, I don't know if you know me, but this is just, it's not practical. Move along. You can have a cynical response. Yeah, we'll see about it. If it happens, it happens, but I'm not counting on it or anything. How about like just a, okay, thanks. Rando. Or Jacob just seems to feel like this was not just some ordinary run-of-the-mill dream. This was an actual conversation. This wasn't just something I made up in my skull. God met me there. And his response seems to reflect exactly that. Overwhelming hope. Like the tears in your eyes kind of hope. Like, I needed kindness so bad. I needed something. I need to dare to believe that this could be true. And he whispers. I love that he whispers, incredible, wonderful, holy. And God doesn't put down a condition in this contract. He just says, this is just all the good stuff I'm going to do for you. No condition. Not because you've earned it. I just chose you. And Jacob's response is really interesting. He gives a condition back. If you stay with me, if you protect me, if you give me a home. It's a hilarious moment, I think, because God just said, here's all the things I'm going to do for your kids, for your family in perpetuity, blah, blah, blah. And Jacob said, great, great, great. If you take care of me, here's what I'll do for you. This really funny moment. But something in this kid has moved enough that he's like, this just feels like it demands a response. If you are who you say you are, if you're going to do these things, 10% of everything that I make here, anything that grows here, if you follow through, it's yours. And then you get this hilarious moment in the scene. You've got a kid talking to his pillow, which is now a statue, and he's pouring oil on it, and somebody's walking by like, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, we're not going to call this Castle Rock anymore. We're going to call it Bethel. And they're just backing away slowly. I'm like, this kid's not okay. Bethel means God's house. And in the geography of what would become the nation of Israel, this continues to become an incredibly important spot. From here in the story, I'm going to oversimplify some things. Jacob does end up making it all the way to his uncle Laban's house, and there he begins a family. He begins amassing wealth, like a lot of wealth. And he ends up taking his whole family by a long route. They end up in Egypt, of all places. And over time, Jacob passes away, and generation after generation after generation continue to do okay. And then all of a sudden, Egypt gains a little bit more control over this family. And then we find ourselves in a scene where Egypt has enslaved the entire nation of Israel. Until one day, God makes the move to get them out of their slavery. And once again, we have a God who's finding kids who are homeless. Some kids who are messed up and who have nothing. And he intervenes. And we come full circle, because now generations later, Moses is talking to all of Jacob's descendants, these Hebrew people who have just escaped Egypt. They finally made it out. They're trying to get to their way back home. They're walking up and getting closer to a place called Bethel and to a place called Israel. And then Moses in Deuteronomy 26 says, hey, in the midst of all these other things that we've been talking about, here's the speech that I want to make sure that you give. Every year, when your crops grow, take the first 10%. No matter where you live in the nation, you're going to bring it to the temple. And when you get there, you're going to give it to the priest. And you're going to say this, a wandering Aramean was my father. He went down to Egypt, and he sojourned there. He and just a handful of his brothers, but soon they became a great nation, mighty and many. The Egyptians abused and battered us in a cruel and savage slavery. We cried out to God, the God of our fathers. He listened to our voice. He saw our destitution, our trouble, our cruel plight, and God took us out of Egypt with his strong hand and long arm, terrible and great, with signs and miracle wonders. And he brought us to this place. He gave us this land flowing with milk and honey. So here I am. I've brought the first fruits of what I've grown on this ground that you gave me, O God. God is telling Moses to remind the people, don't forget, you promised. I have followed through on my end. Don't forget that you made a vow to me. While I was unconditional, you were conditional. So don't forget. But above the 10%, above the stuff, God's saying, don't forget when we made this vow. Don't forget how you made this vow. Don't forget it. And when you arrive, when you experience how good my gifts are, when I follow through, you're going to be tempted to forget. If you forget that you were once homeless, you'll forget to care for the homeless among you. Don't forget your story, and you won't forget them. And in all of this, you won't forget me. I don't know if you caught it, but right at the end, and in the practice of this, what becomes the festival of the first fruits, the idea was, as I'm walking towards the temple, if I spot somebody who is an alien or an orphan or a widow, if I find somebody in need who's been marginalized, right there on the spot, I can just hand over, here's everything you're going to need for the year. Here's 10% of what I grew. And right there on the spot, I give my speech. I am the son of a wandering Aramean. And then you can go back home. The priestly class, the Levites, were another group. If you stumbled upon one of them before you got to the temple, here's everything you're going to need. And let me just give the speech. If you made it all the way to the temple, the whole purpose of getting it to the temple was so that the priests who worked at the temple could redistribute it to who? The alien and the orphan and the widow, the most marginalized in our community. In a place where a lot of these cultures said, well, God, the gods need this. It's what sustains them. It's part of this like conditional contract that we have between us and them. The God of this story says, no, this has always been about caring for the outcast, finding the homeless kids. And you'll get it if you remember that it started with you. You used to be this way. And I gave you a home because I followed through on a promise I made you with no condition. Now take care of all the homeless kids. Understand the story. I want you to remember where you came from. And so this speech, what is it? It's really just saying, we were homeless kids. We were running from home. We had messed up. We had nothing, no belongings, no future, no hope. But I'm no longer doomed. I have a future. I've been promised heaven. But not only that, I have something now, like a whole way of living. You've given me words of life, a roadmap to base my life around a good life. The grace to practice it instead of the pressure of having to be perfect at it. You've given me a family and a story. I get to be a part of this whole story. I am a part of a community now where I have brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and, of course, the little stuff. Some of us have homes and jobs and possessions, children of our own. All of that is a gift of God to me. I've just become aware of it. And God's end here. God gave us a new home. Not just a place that I go when I die, but the fuller idea that the kingdom of heaven is now. That I'm part of that country now. I have citizenship with him now. He gave us a family, and a family that the whole earth is being blessed through. That the local church is a place that doesn't just plant and then build walls and it's like a foxhole to try and survive the community around, but a place through which to say, how can we love and support? Particularly, how can we walk around and go, we're the alien, the orphan, the widow. We're the most marginalized in our community, and how can we meaningfully come alongside them? God is with us and is protecting us and is bringing us home. And our promise back. There was a story going on here long before I came on scene, and I am swept up in it. I am at least as grateful as Jacob was for this hope. I'm with him. So here's my response. You take care of the powerless, all of us. And I still need you. Without you, I'm homeless. I'm running. I have nothing, no future, no hope. There's just not a good outcome. So I'll give you my first 10%. I'll look for the poor and the marginalized in my community as I move towards them together with you. And this gift is a declaration of hope at the end. Something that shows your trust and belief, not just in a God who is growing grain in your field, but trust in a God who has been following through on his promises for generations. A God who loves to remind you who you are and who he is, and that everything you've been given is a complete act of grace. So what's this 10% idea? What's this tithe? How do you actually do it? I'm going to move through this really quickly, but I think it's really cool to know how they would practice it. Moses, in their era, they would tie a reed around the first 10% of their crop that would grow in their field, and whatever grew out of those crops, that's what became the 10% that you take in. And it's a really weird idea, I think, because how do you know what's going to be 10%? The rest hasn't grown yet. What if a plague comes? What if there's no rain? Already in this story, I'm having to trust God that he's going to continue to take care of me. They would take that down to the temple if they'd come across an orphan or a widow. Here you go. Or you could get all the way there, and again, it would just be redistributed. And I love this. It just seems like it's such a God move. If you want to love me, God seems to say, care for the most vulnerable around you, and you'll find me there. Jesus had a lot to say, actually, about stuff like that. And then you give this speech. It's not just a monetary exchange. It's a story. It's a family. It's something that you're saying, I am swept up in this thing that I'm a part of now. I want to be in on the promises that it just seems like God's really good at following through on. Just for giggles, what if you had a killer year? Like, what if your 10% actually only ended up being like 6%? Or what if it was a terrible year and your 10% ended up being like 100%? Every 3 years, if you read the verses that follow immediately after, you would do a bit of an audit just to make sure that whatever had been growing by the end of the season came to an amount of roughly 10%. It was a year to catch up. If you were given less, you could just adjust. It's really cool, a 3-year tithe audit. Many of us give through an auto pay system, whether that's to a church, whether that's to other nonprofits around town, and that's great. Because it's so easy at tax time to know what percentage is. And you can forget about it month to month. It's not that big of a deal. But we do miss out on this speech idea. What would it be like every month, or maybe it's just every year when you do your taxes, to have something like this? A prayer that you pray when you get your bank statement. Or at the very least, something that you say that just keeps you rooted in the story. It just seems like at this point for God, the point for God was far less about the percentage and so much more about the story. Are you needing one of them, the percentage or the story? Know that it's all just an invitation to respond to God, not just to make sure that you're following the rules. I invite you to consider what your 10% is. If you haven't looked at it in a bit, maybe today is the day or the week to have a moment to really dust it off and just check to see. What are the numbers? And maybe most importantly, what's the story that goes with it? And who's it going towards? Is it the most marginalized and vulnerable? Who can't function without the gift of folks who are obedient like this? And for those who are on this journey towards Jesus, I would simply say this: give out of your story, not out of your wallet. This was never something that God demanded. He has always been unconditional. This was our choice to respond to him in this way, and it still is. It's a response that communicates, I understand what you're offering me, and I trust you. And it keeps you rooted in your past and in your future. And for those of us who might be new to this, who are just checking out the claims of Christ, just want you to know, this is what's so cool about how this particular God works. The offer's on the table. You want to stop running? Want to have somebody protect you? Do you need a home? You're invited to give as well, but the giving really only makes sense when the story is behind it. So be generous. It is a good thing. But know that when it comes out of this place, when it comes out of this story, it's a response that says, well, a while back I was a college kid hanging out with a therapist, freaking out. Because I was homeless, and I was so aware of how hopeless I was at that time. And I was not convinced I had much future to run on. And in that moment, God came in and he said, I can come in, and I can tidy this up, and I can keep it clean. Or, like grown Zach last week, who's realizing, man, the amount of stuff that I have stacked up, they're like, this just ain't right. I've not done a good job. That God comes in and says, hey, we're going to forgive that. I'm going to find you on the road down to Bethel. I'm going to remind you that I am unconditional. This is not about a performance on your end. And without condition, I just have hope and goodness to just generously spew everywhere. And I just get to be this homeless kid who's like, he gave me everything all over again. That's the point of all of this. I'm going to bring out the band. But if I could take this speech and instead of having it start with a wandering Aramean was my father and update it with some modern language for us, I would offer this. And if this is something that you would say, like, send that to me, I want to attach that to my taxes every year. or I want to have that handy every time I get a bank statement. What would it be like to be able to say something like this? God, I come from a tribe of people who wandered from home and from you, and I am no different. I was taken captive and enslaved and abused. I cried out to you, and then when there was little reason for you to respond, you did. You listened. You looked for me, and when you found me, you rescued me in dramatic fashion. You brought me back home to be with you and to give me a future that is peaceful and good and beautiful. So here I am. I've brought you the first part of what I'm depending on this year. I'm not sure if there will be more, but you've always provided when I've trusted you. I wanted to give it back to you because that's what those who came before me promised they would do. And I want you to know that no matter what happens, I know I'll be okay if I'm with you. You promised I would be. You haven't broken a single promise yet. So here it is. I trust you for the rest. I hope today that you don't hear me talking about money. I mean, it's such a small part of what's going on in this story and in your story and in this story. And it is a story, thankfully, that does invite a response. It is unconditionally offered. How do you respond? One of the ways that we can respond today, which is no small thing, is to simply give a speech back. Sometimes that comes with something that we find in Deuteronomy 26, and sometimes that comes with just singing things that are true. And so for those who are able, let's stand and sing together.